It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And Mayor de Blasio joins us first today for our weekly Ask the Mayor segment. Our phones are open for anything you want to ask the mayor today. You know, sometimes we have a specific topic, sometimes we don't. Today, it's open. Anything you want to ask Mayor de Blasio at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or tweet your question with the hashtag Ask the Mayor. Mr. Mayor, welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
And we have to deal with some tough stuff today. Let me begin with a heartbreaking and apparently outrageous failure on the part of the Administration for Children's Services, which everybody now acknowledges, in the case of six-year-old Zaimir Perkins from Harlem, who was beaten to death in September despite ACS having looked into five incidents involving possible abuse by his mother and her boyfriend, who have both been arrested now. An investigation by the state has found multiple missed opportunities to intervene before it was too late. Apparently, ACS failed to follow up after there were allegations that Zaimir had a fractured jaw. His mother denied it, but there was no follow-up with the doctor. They also didn't follow up on excessive absences from schools, and there were other things. These incidents piled up for months. We can't bring back Zaimir Perkins, but the implication is that this is part of a larger breakdown at ACS. How do you assess the agency?
Look, I want to be careful about that implication. What happened here was unacceptable, and we've been very blunt from the very beginning. When I first met with the media on this case, I've said this was unacceptable, and our mission is to save every child. You know, Brian, unlike pretty much any other area in government, we do not set a standard of perfection in policing or so many other areas. In this case, we do set a standard of perfection. Our mission is to save every single child. And what happened here shouldn't have happened. And there have been immediately consequences for those who were directly involved. Some have been terminated. Some have been demoted. And it's very clear that we have to do more to make sure that something like this never happens again. We have put a huge amount of investment into an agency that for years had disinvestment. We've put in more staff. We've reduced case workloads. We've added more training of people who do the work. But there's more that we have to do. And I think the bottom line is I've been working on these issues for many years, as I think you know, including I was chair of the relevant committee in the city council when Nixmary Brown died, and a whole host of changes were needed then. The city has come a long way since those days, but we've got to do more, and I'm committed to doing it.
I believe on Tuesday, when you last took reporters' questions on this, you said you were appointing an independent monitor for ACS, but the state report seems to say it was something the city was being compelled to do. Were you not disclosing that for some reason?
First of all, we're very comfortable doing it. So the word compelled is when there's some difference. We have no problem with it. I think it's a good idea. We're happy to do it. We believe it's the right thing to do. Second, the state had not formally put that out publicly, and it's not my place to speak for the state of New York. So we are going to have an independent monitor, someone above the fray who can look at this and help us find any other areas that we got to improve. We're going to keep improving. We're going to get a new commissioner, obviously, who is going to be someone we believe can deepen these reforms. But this work, and I can say it from the 8 years I spent in oversight of this agency, this work never ends. It's we're trying to deal with some of the worst human dynamics, families that have fallen apart, people who, for a variety of reasons, would turn to violence against their own children, which is unbelievable to me as a parent. But that's how bad situations have become in certain people's lives. Our job is to get there first and intervene and stop it. Which, again, makes it different from almost any other area of government where you know we don't have the assumption that we can intervene before every bad thing happens in terms of social issues and things facing our society. In this one, it's our job to get there first and stop these things from happening. We need the public to participate. And one thing I'd say, Brian, constantly is if anyone believes a child is in danger, they need to call either 311 or, if urgent, an immediate 911. And get connected to the state registry so we can follow up, and we need the most information we can get. And that's one of the things that helps us get there early and save children.
Your ACS commissioner, Gladys Carrion, resigned this week, and you said it was unrelated. But must she not have failed, considering the state's findings in this and, I guess, a few other cases as well?
I don't think that's fair, Brian. This is someone who's literally given 40 years of her life to helping children and protecting children. The reforms she did, you know, she had the role of state commissioner before coming to the city. She instituted some groundbreaking reforms, highly respected reforms to provide a better pathway for young people who have gotten in trouble, and a model very much adopted by the Bloomberg administration and my administration. And then she came in and governed over a constant reinvestment in ACS, which had not been invested in sufficiently in the previous administration. She added a lot more training and professional development for the people who work. Something went horribly wrong, and a number of individuals did not do their job, and they are paying for that. And if we find anyone else in any other case who doesn't do their job, they'll pay for it.
Those were the individual caseworkers. Are you saying this is just a case of a few bad Apple caseworkers?
Brian, I think it's a couple of different things we have to recognize. This agency handles over 50,000 cases a year, and in a large number of situations saves children, gets them out of dangerous homes, or provides the support to turn families around. That was on Gladys Carillon's watch, too. This time, the agency failed. Now, I want to know more about the exact reasons, if there were systemic reasons, and that's something the monitor will help us with. But what we know immediately is a group of individuals did not do their job. Sometimes it is people who don't do their job, and those people need to pay. But don't forget the people every single day working at ACS who do their job and protect children. You, no disrespect to you personally, but you will never report on that once. I guarantee it. There is never a report of when children are saved. There's only a report of when a tragedy happens.
Another tough subject. Sorry. Your campaign fundraising is back in the news, and I'm going to ask you a few questions about that. The New York Times reports both the New York State grand jury and a federal grand jury are now hearing testimony. The feds are asking whether there was illegal pressure on people with business before the city to donate to your campaign or a related political group, or if there were any quid pro quos for donations. The state is asking whether there was solicitation of illegal donations to upstate Democratic county committees to avoid campaign finance limits on giving to actual candidates in state Senate races up there. I know you say your hands are clean in all these matters. The Times speculates that we'll finally know in a matter of weeks if you or any of your aides will be indicted. Is that the timeline you now expect?
I don't expect timelines. That's up to the folks doing the investigations. What we've said very clearly, we have cooperated from moment one. We've offered any and all information they needed and all the cooperation in the world. The only thing we care about is getting to resolution. I think the public would like to get to resolution as quickly as appropriate, but that's up to the folks doing the investigations. With all due respect to your characterization, Brian, you can ask it or raise it any way you want, but I've said very, very consistently, and the facts keep proving this to be the case, one, we did things the right way and by the law. Two, we sought legal guidance throughout, either from campaign lawyers or from the Conflict Interest Board in the case of the Campaign for One New York. We disclosed everything we were doing, which is why people are asking specific questions. We never provided any undue favors or anything for anybody who was a donor. We made decisions on the merits. You can ask it 1,000 times, I'm going to answer the same way, because that's exactly what happened. So we will cooperate, we'll provide all the information in the world, and we're very, very comfortable with it. I'm very comfortable with it because I know we did things the right way.
The Daily News reported on one of you and your top fundraiser, Russ Offinger's action soliciting donations far in excess of typical amounts from lobbyists representing clients with business before the city, and that early in your administration, Offinger circulated a list of those donors. What should the public think about that report?
I think that's been wildly mischaracterized. There was a time when we were trying to gather support for the pre-K initiative, and he suggested business leaders who might be willing to join into that effort as a matter of a public support base, which is perfectly normal to get from someone who knows those people. But the bigger point is, let's look at the whole crux of what all this is about. It's about two things: the Campaign for One New York, which worked diligently to get pre-K for all the children in New York City, and affordable housing, including the legislation guaranteeing affordable housing and new development, that developers would be required to create affordable housing and new development, which is groundbreaking and the most progressive of legislation in the country, and the effort to turn the state Senate Democratic. If we had a Democratic state Senate, that would have led to much more support for rent regulation, stronger rent regulation, more support for affordable housing programs, more support for what we're trying to do on education, and a host of other reforms, including public financing of elections. which Democrats support and Republicans don't, which is one of the ultimate reforms. So I was working diligently to elect a Democratic state senate, which I think is what Democrats are supposed to do and would have been very good for everything we're trying to do in New York City.
Well, that's the goal.
That's why we were doing these things.
That's the goal. But the news says of the $4.3 million that your campaign for One New York, that's the issues group, raised, $3 million of the $4.3 million came from donors who had business before the city. What should listeners think of that?
Again, everything by the law. One, by the law. And, Brian, we have to be really clear. The law is what governs everything in relationship to donations. I think people should be very concerned when someone doesn't follow the law. When people follow the law, as we did, getting constant guidance from our lawyers, getting constant guidance from the Conflict of Interest Board, and then disclosing everything, which is always a crucial thing. People who disclose everything tend to be people who are very comfortable with all the facts coming out, and I am. What matters here is we did everything by the law for good causes. You know there's plenty of scandals in New York State about people trying to put money in their own pockets or doing things immoral. The work we did was by the law, appropriate, above board, to win pre-K, affordable housing, a Democratic state senate. And those were the right things to work for. Everything disclosed. No influence given to anyone in exchange. It's a whole conundrum, Brian, facing our entire campaign finance system. What we should have is full public financing of elections. We should have a whole host of reforms that take money out of the equation in general. But since Citizens United, what we're really living in is a world where a lot of people want unilateral disarmament. They want the wealthy and folks who, for example, have done huge amounts of advertising against me, such as some of the hedge fund folks, to have all the freedom in the world to not disclose and spend anything they want, when the rest of us try to fight back and do it above board and with disclosure and with no inappropriate activity, it becomes such a major issue.
So,
you know, it's funny. I'll finish on this. I think a lot of people should ask this question in the media. Are you ever going to look at all the wealthy and powerful people who spend endless amounts of undisclosed money? Is that ever going to interest you?
Well, we do that all the time on this show. We certainly break down the excesses of Citizens United on a regular basis. But when we look locally, New York City is supposed to be immune from some of that because we have one of the most progressive campaign finance laws in the country because of the 6-to-1 matches for small donations to candidates. So the very existence of your Campaign for One New York Issues Group as an entity outside that system comes under scrutiny. And here is, it's not just the media saying it, here is City Council Speaker Melissa Mark Viverito yesterday on a bill that they now have to ban such groups as loopholes.
We won't know for certain what happened with the Campaign for One New York until investigations into this practice have concluded, but we do know that it exposed loopholes in our election and ethics laws, and we need to be, that need to be remedied, and we are doing that today with this bill.
So do you support the bill and the underlying idea that you and other politicians shouldn't have these avenues to take donations from interested parties?
I support the bill, but, Brian, I'm not going to fail to note the contradiction. And again, folks who are supposed to be the watchdog here are not looking at the whole picture. We'll do this bill because it's necessary. But what it also means is that anyone who wants to attack a mayor or the city council or anything with endless amounts of money, there's now no counterbalance in the equation. And I think at some point people are going to realize that's a problem.
Because the Supreme Court enables it?
Because the Supreme Court enables it, and because there's not parity in how it's looked at. We've seen in this very state vast amounts of money spent by similar groups, no effort being made to figure out in a meaningful way who those donors are. When I had $5 million of advertising thrown at me in the first month of my administration by hedge fund folks, there was no serious effort by the media to figure out who those folks were and what kind of influence they're using over this city. So we'll do this legislation.
That was about charter schools primarily, right?
Sure it was, but
you say you
very
needed
wealthy
this
hedge fund folks trying to influence government policy with the money they had, and no one looked into it.
But you say you needed this Campaign for One New York money to get universal pre-K, which
because
almost nobody opposed.
Brian, go back and check your facts, my friend. Those same groups were opposing. Remember the famous rally in Albany? We had a rally for pre-K. There was a counter-rally that day by an organization deeply backed by these same hedge fund donors. come on, there was plenty of effort to undermine our pre-K initiative, particularly the part about taxing those who made over $500,000 to pay for it. You don't think there were a lot of wealthy interests trying to stop us from taxing people who made over $500,000 in the city?
You're right about
that. I don't think you're
naive. You're right about the funding. And yes, that was a point of dispute between you and Governor Cuomo, how it would be funded.
And a lot of other powerful forces. And lo and behold, how the state Senate Republicans and ultimately the governor and many other forces stopped us from getting the ability to tax ourselves, the people of New York City. I won an election with 73% of the vote saying my number one agenda item was to put on a tax on those who made $500,000 or more so we could pay for pre-K, taxing our own people. 73% of the people voted for it. It was stopped by Albany. One of the reasons was the same wealthy interests that were attacking me on charter school issues, the same hedge fund folks. Never was looked into coherently. Look at the column inches on that versus the column inches on this, and you'll understand my frustration.
And one last thing on campaign finances. Your campaign for mayor for 2013 was fined $47,000 for violations that were identified. And here's a question via Twitter for you from a listener on one of them. I don't know if he was a campaign donor. He would probably have had to been for this question to be accurate. But this says, did the mayor stay at a hotel an hour from his daughter's college with my money? Because you listed that visit to California as a campaign expense, even though it's been reported that there was only one meeting with a donor or one donation made, but you were also visiting your daughter at college in California.
We believe everything we did, which always is cleared with lawyers, was done appropriately. We disagree with the campaign finance board. We had thorough discussion with them, showing them why we believe that their understanding was wrong. If you go and you pursue donations for a campaign, and that can be about the immediate donations, and it could be about building a bigger support base for the future and future event, absolutely normal in political fundraising. That's how we did things. And everything was appropriate. In the end, it's never a shock, and you can ask any candidate. The campaign finance board makes its own decisions, and you know, $47,000 compared to a campaign that I think was about $15 million total, it's pretty de minimis. We, in the end, agreed, fine, we will pay it, but we don't agree with it.
Let's take some phone calls. It's our Ask the Mayor segment on WNYC with Mayor Bill de Blasio, 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Rick in Queens has an affordable housing question. You're on WNYC. Rick, hello.
Yes. Thank you, Brian and Mayor de Blasio, for your many years of service. I want to talk about an alternative way to generate affordable middle-income housing and get your take on it. I'm Rick Ulfick, founder of We the World and the We campaign at We.net. We promote...
Rick, right to your question. What do you want to know from the mayor?
Yeah, so right now you could say that the real estate industry in New York City is what you could call a gentrification machine. So my suggestion is to introduce a public option into the middle-income housing marketplace, similar to the public option concept in healthcare. So instead of fighting tooth and nail to get real estate developers to accept 70% market rate, 30% affordable housing, or 80-20 deals, which just feed and increase gentrification, if you want to make progress to actually reduce inequality in New York City.
Okay.
How about
Rick, forgive me, but you've gone on too long, so I have to get a response. What about some kind of public option?
Well, I don't honestly, Rick, thank you for your comment, and I don't honestly understand the concept here, but let me say a simple thing that the base of Rick's question, Brian, this is what people are talking about all over New York City, and I think we should be talking about a lot more, including on this show, is the impact of gentrification and the affordability crisis. And I think we have to have a much deeper conversation in the city. I tried in one of my State of the City addresses to really spark a conversation about what gentrification means, what its pros and cons are, what are the proper public policy responses, because honestly, I believe in the 20 years before I took office, there was a very laissez-faire approach by my two predecessors that who let gentrification proceed without any meaningful public intervention. We're trying to fix that with a whole host of public interventions, including the law I mentioned earlier, requiring developers to create affordable housing in developments that we put through rezonings, the rent freeze for 2 million New Yorkers that we've had the last 2 years, the anti-eviction legal services that's reduced eviction by 24%. These are the kinds of things we need to address gentrification. And it's really a conversation, because I hear so much frustration in the public about gentrification and trying to process what it means. I think we need a more real conversation about what public policy can affect and what it can't, what the market is doing, no matter what the government does versus what the government can intervene on. So I don't know what he means by public option, but I do believe the city government needs to be aggressive in confronting gentrification in a lot of ways.
Doreen and Sunnyside, you're on WNYC with the mayor. Hi, Doreen.
Hi, Brian, and hi, Mr. Mayor. I just have a question about the two little girls in the Bronx that were killed by that radiator. And I'm wondering, what is the systemic problem where a landlord who has, you know, been reported that there was repeated violations in his building, that he's basically a slumlord, and he has been paid by the city to house homeless people. Isn't that, like, a big problem?
Doreen, thank you for the question. Look, this is a horrible, horrible tragedy. I was in the room where those girls were sleeping. I saw it, you know, hours later, and it's just incredibly painful to see, especially as a parent. The problem here is two things. One, we're still trying to understand how such a tragedy could occur, because there's just no precedent for something like this. And, you know, the fire department and others are still analyzing how on earth it could have happened. From everything we know, it was just a horrible, perfect storm accident, and we did not have the different agencies involved, and the nonprofit that was managing the building did not have an indication that anything like this could happen, or of course we would have intervened. But the second piece of the equation is, why are we in a building like that to begin with a landlord like that? Because what happened is the cost of housing has created such pressure on people, and this is what's driving this increase in the number of folks who end up in homeless shelter, that we are literally constantly running out of space for people who are perfectly good, in many cases, hardworking people, have a job and literally can't afford their apartment anymore. Even though we're trying to offer subsidies, we're trying to provide lawyers to stop evictions, this is the result of a growing problem in the city of the cost of housing continuing to go up while wages and benefits don't. We're trying to fix that, both in terms of more affordable housing and raising wages and benefits and creating more high-quality jobs. But right now, we're in a crisis. So we're in a building like that because we don't have a better alternative to get people to. As soon as we do, we're getting out of those buildings, those cluster buildings, or we're converting them to affordable housing, taking them over and upgrading them and making them permanent affordable housing.
Doreen, thank you very much. An Ask the Mayor question via Twitter from Roxanne in the Bronx, using the hashtag Ask the Mayor. Was it really necessary to kill the deer in Harlem?
I'm not an expert on this, Brian, but everything I understand was, here's the problem. Obviously, a deer does not belong in the middle of an urban neighborhood, in the middle of a housing authority development. There was danger if that deer went out on the streets. There's danger that there could have been a car crash. You could have had numerous human beings harmed in addition to the deer. So the protocol, as I understand it from the folks who are the animal experts, is if the deer cannot be left where they are, and it could not be left in the streets of Harlem, I'm sorry, that's just absolutely unacceptable and dangerous. They have to be removed. If you remove them, there's no option. There's no other place to take them. If a deer is already in a natural location and you can leave them there, then they have a chance of survival. But if not, you don't really have another option. That's my understanding from our folks who work in this field.
I'm no expert either, but in theory, if you put a deer back in a natural environment, it might have a chance to survive or die of natural causes, and at least, or even, you know, predatory by other animals, which could be natural causes in the scheme of creatures, but not at
the
hands of people.
Yeah, I would have thought that too. And what I'm told, and again, forgive me, I'm getting this secondhand, but what I'm told is what that actually is inhumane in its own right. You take, like any other creature, they're used to a certain environment. You put them in a new environment, even in nature, It's traumatizing. It creates all sorts of extended pain and usually leads to death. So I think this is a case where it's a really bad situation, unfortunately, if a deer ends up in the middle of an urban area. It's nothing any of us want. But I think it's a question of, you know, is it going to be a quick and merciful death versus potentially a very long, painful process? That's the governing philosophy, as best I understand it.
Another tough topic, and this is not about something you or your administration did or even allegedly did. It now apparently turns out to have been a hoax that the 18-year-old Baruch College student, Yasmin Sawaid, who got a lot of publicity saying three drunk men pulled her hijab shouting Trump while bystanders did nothing, that didn't happen. This is bad in and of itself, obviously, but it's even worse when the NYPD is reporting a spike in verifiable hate crimes.
Yeah.
When a very vivid story of one like this turns out to be fake, this is what the general public remembers. And the whole idea that Trump and his appointees are fostering an anti-Muslim atmosphere is taken with skepticism, gets written off despite the increase in real incidents that have been verified, and the atmosphere toward Muslims becomes even more suspicious. What would you like to say about this case in New York City?
I appreciate that question. I agree with you 100%, Brian. I'm really angry at this young woman for, doing a huge disservice to everyone. She did a disservice to the NYPD that put real time and energy into investigating her claim, which is another example of how diligent the NYPD is when they get reports of hate crimes. She did a disservice to the taxpayers. She did a disservice to the truth. And you're exactly right. There is an obvious spike in hate crimes. We can't have deniers telling us that the rhetoric of many people, including Donald Trump, didn't lead to that. And she, in effect, is enabling those who say, oh, it's not a big deal. So, you know, I can't account for individual human failings, but I can say this is deeply troubling. And anyone within the sound of my voice, don't even think about making a false report, because there are real consequences. And now she is going to face real consequences for what she did.
Indira in Pauling, you're on WNYC with Mayor de Blasio. Hello.
Thank you, Brian. Good morning, Mr. Mayor. I just wanted to ask a quick question, and I'm not certain if you would be able to answer it, but at least you can point me in the right direction. Monday morning, this past Monday, the 12th, my husband was in a head-on collision on Mott Avenue in Far Rockaway on his way to work, and it took police officers 2.5 hours to come and assess the situation and remove the cars, have them towed and everything. No ambulance ever came. 911 was called four times. And it took me 3 hours to get there from Pauling just to get him to go to the hospital. And I was wondering, is there anything that anyone in our position could have done to mitigate that ridiculous wait on a lane that is on a road that is so incredibly busy like Mott Avenue and in a really rough neighborhood where we couldn't even leave the car to go find a police officer? And if you, I can take my question and answer offline. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much, Indira. I'm very troubled by this report, and it's unacceptable on many levels. Of course, a head-on collision would suggest you need not only police, as you said, you needed EMS to come immediately. And I've worked with the police in the Rockaways, and I've found them to be very effective and responsive, so I don't know how on earth this could have happened. We're going to look into this case. That time frame is absolutely unacceptable by any measure. Does not make sense to me how that could have happened. Brian, we will look into it if you can make sure your folks shared information, and I want to make sure we publicly air the response on this one because that would not be acceptable under any situation.
Okay. Indira hung up to listen to the answer on the air, but Indira, if you want to call back, we'll take your contact information off the air and pass it on to City Hall. Matt in Merrick, you're on WNYC. Hello, Matt.
Hey, thanks, Brian, for taking my call. Good morning, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, I wanted to start by saying that I appreciate what Mayor de Blasio had to say about, that it's not newsworthy when ACS saves a lot of lives, and I take that to heart because I'm an attorney for ACS and I'm a supervising attorney. But my question is specifically about, Mr. Mayor, your advisory committee on judges and how personally involved you are in the selection of them, because I think one of the problems we're having lately that's been an added stressor for us, but more importantly, I think a problem for children that are in some jeopardy is some of the new family court judges that we've been receiving, especially in Brooklyn. As a supervising attorney, I've been running to the appellate division seeking stays of orders from judges sending children home to homes that ACS has determined to be completely hazardous to children, that would place children at imminent risk to their life or health. And having judges either send these kids home that we've already removed or deny our request to remove these children, and we're running to the Appellate Division on emergency stay applications on a weekly basis and having them grant the emergency stay applications because they can't believe the craziness of the decisions that the family court judges have made. So my question is, how personally involved are you in selecting the candidates that are recommended to you, and you know, whether or not there's any plan to try and, you know, have some more oversight or do some more thorough vetting of some of the candidates that are coming to you for nomination?
Ben, I appreciate the question. Very quickly, and thank you for all you're doing. I want to repeat the point. There's well over 50,000 reports a year of potential child abuse that ACS investigates, and the vast majority of cases, children are kept, the children are kept safe, including very dramatic and powerful interventions by ACS that get no attention whatsoever. And then every year, there are two or three or four cases that get tons of attention, and they're horrible cases, and they should not happen, and we're never going to stop working to stop it. But I do want to respect the people who do the work, like you, Matt, and so many others. 50,000-plus children protected every single year and get no attention or respect for that. The second point, I personally interview everybody that we appoint for family court judges. There's a very elaborate screening process, and some of my senior people, including my corporation counsel, Zach Carter, are deeply involved in that screening process. But I make the ultimate decisions on who gets those appointments. Then we do evaluate regularly what's going on. I agree with you. There's a concern. I'm not going to specify it to Brooklyn or anyplace else. But I can say a fact that I'm going to be looking into and I think should be looked at publicly. ACS has often asked for children to be removed from the home, and judges have denied it. And this is another variable in the equation. And, Brian, this is worthy of more discussion and more evaluation and more consideration by the media. If ACS does everything it's supposed to do and says to a judge, we want this child out of the home, we don't think it's safe, and the judge denies it, ACS does not have the power to overrule the judge. They need a judge's order, except in emergency situations that are literally life and death at that exact moment. They need a judge's order. And this is a frustration for us when we feel we've documented why a child should come out of the home and a judge disagrees. That's checks and balances, but often checks and balances we disagree with. So, Matt, you're right that we are going to keep pressing to get more and more judges to accept that recommendation. But I am confident that the people I'm choosing as family court judge are hearing that that's a deep concern of mine.
I know we're over time, but just to follow up on this for 1 second, Matt, your impression as an attorney and Mr. Mayor, there's a movement that we've reported on in the past by advocates for the mostly minority, mostly mothers, biological mothers of children in these situations where sometimes it's a close call as to whether to work with the mother or remove the child from the home. And there's a pushback. That's a political advocacy movement that says the state is too quick to remove children, and there's racial bias in these cases as well over many, 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 many years. And so it's a difficult balance as to when to remove a child out of either an abundance of caution or the right amount of caution, how much actually victimizes a biological parent's right. Matt, you're familiar with the push and pull, right?
No question. And I certainly, I actually very much appreciate the institutional providers that we have to work with in Brooklyn. They're called Brooklyn Defender Services. We certainly work with Legal Aid Society, who represents the interests of children. I know in the Bronx, Bronx Defenders has been leading defense advocate. There's no question that the group of parents who have a constitutional right to have their children in their home are much better served now by these institutional providers than they probably have been in the past by some, not all, but some court-appointed counsel. So I appreciate that, and I think they do a stellar job. And I think ACS, I've been doing child protective work for, since I've been admitted. I used to do it upstate, and when I relocated about 3 years ago to the city, I've been working in Brooklyn exclusively since then. I have tremendous respect for my colleagues across the aisle. I think they do a great job. I also think ACS has moved in a direction where the calculus is more balanced, and I think there is more thought and certainly work between the caseworkers that are on the field that see what's going on in their consultation with us, you know, in family court legal services before a case is filed and action is taken. The point that, and in the cases that I'm speaking about, are not as close cases. I mean, these aren't the cases that you know, maybe it's a neglect case and there's poverty issues and there's domestic violence issues and there's immigration issues and all these other stressors.
So if it's not close, why won't the judge order the removal, in your opinion?
You know, Brian, I'm scratching my head about that. Without certainly naming names or getting to specifics, you know, there's one particular case that that was personally invested in which, certainly by any standard of case law, statute, which is Section 1027 of the Family Court Act, that there was a particular case where a child had many, many unexplained marks and bruises. The parent's story was deemed by a medical expert to not be consistent, did not make any sense. For whatever reason, the judge was particularly endeared to this particular respondent and refused to remove the child.
One indication. And I have to leave it there. Mr. Mayor, I know you got to go. You want to give one last response to this?
Yeah, I appreciate it. Look, the bottom line is there. You're right, Brian, to your question. There has been an understandable movement to say, beware the unintended consequences that when you remove a child from a home, if it is like a on the cusp kind of case, you remove a child from the home, that has a real impact on the child, on the family. It can have real negative consequences. I think there are situations where you can say we're going to keep trying to work within the family context, and that's why I've always supported adding preventative services so there's trained social workers who go in, work with the family, try and resolve the problems, try and make sure everyone is safe. We've put a lot of investment into that, and when it works, it's a great alternative to removal. But here's the problem. When ACS says, look, we've tried everything else, and we think it's literally a potential matter of life and death, we want that child out of the home. I think that is pretty damn clear when all other alternatives have been tried, and ACS believes it's time to take that step, even if it's a radical step. I believe the benefit of the doubt should go to ACS and the work they've done. I know judges are there to exercise their individual judgment, and sometimes it might be fair to say the case being made of why a child should be removed isn't strong enough, and the judge wants more proof. Okay, that's checks and balances. But I can tell you for a fact, there are times when I think ACS has been 100% right about removal, and it would have been the safer and more prudent thing to do, and individual judges have said no. And we have to be fair to ACS in this equation. They don't get to be the judge as well.
Well, maybe this will make some news, too, and raise a substantive question for further debate. I really appreciate Matt calling in on this from his post as a lawyer for ACS. And, Mr. Mayor, thank you as always. Talk to you next week.
Take care, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will look into this unbelievable story from North Carolina, a surprise special session of the state legislature, Republican-controlled, to pass bills reducing the power of the governor of the state. They just elected a Democratic governor. This has implications for voting rights, gay rights, and other things in North Carolina. Stay with us.